Today on the Solomon's Corner podcast, we discuss an engagement I had on social media with a Babylon Bee editor about Lizzo and the magic flute. Just kidding. James Madison's flute. We also talk about Marxism once again, because that's what we talked about on the Twitter thread. And then we close out today with a segment on the final chapters of Shezwath Miwosh's The Captive Mind. You're not going to want to miss it. We talk about the church and communism and how Miwosh predicted more than any other chapter the times that we are in.
You are listening to the Solomon's Corner podcast, a place for thinkers. Join us as we explore the depths of theology, philosophy, and the Christian intellectual life.
Welcome to the Solomon's Corner podcast. I'm your host, Daniel Roberts. Now, I know what you're thinking. Man, I could really use a strange habit of mind. Where could I find one, Daniel? Well, let me tell you. Andrew Clavin. He has written a book called The Strange Habit of Mind that drops this year, this month, and also this year, you know. And we put that review up on our website, solomonscorner.com, where you can read the incredibly ambiguous, because I didn't want to give any spoilers, review, and also subscribe to our newsletter to be able to be entered to win a copy of Clavin's new book that drops, I think it's on October 23rd. So if you haven't subscribed to the newsletter yet, make sure you do. Also, we are starting Carl Truman's Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. That starts next Monday, so we will be dropping a podcast on the first couple chapters there. I've already started it. Very excited. Looking like it's definitely in line with some of the readings we've already done. So if you've been following along, you are definitely going to benefit. If not, now's a great time to jump in. Also, if you did not subscribe to the newsletter, tisk, 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 you could have gotten 50% off, but you didn't join the newsletter, so you didn't. So now, make sure you do, so that the next book that we have a deal on, you can get a discount on as well. Finally, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us out with getting guests on the show. If you don't have an Apple Podcast account, make sure you send us a review to mail@solomonscorner.com or, you know, leave us a review on whatever you listen on. But the big one that I have found out from talking to the people in the know is Apple Podcasts. So, especially as we want to secure bigger names next year, which we've already begun to do. We just confirmed our January guest. I'm very excited to announce her when she comes on the show, but we're going to hold it close to the chest until we get closer. We'll probably announce it in December. Also, that leads me to this last announcement, which is in December, we will be taking some time off in order to get some upgrades done on the website and also to secure a couple of events for 2023, speakers, guests, all that fun stuff. So make sure that you don't freak out when you get to December and think that maybe the Grinch has taken Daniel and Lindsay and family away because, you know, it's Christmas and we're gone. So anyway, now to get into the juicy stuff. So I had an interesting interaction last week with a Twitter user who is actually working for the Babylon Bee. Her name is Morgan Is a Wizard, which is a pretty awesome Twitter handle, if I do say so myself. I didn't know who this was. I just saw the argument that she put out on Lizzo playing the magic flute, and I thought it was a bad argument, because it was. Now, Morgan Is a Wizard is probably a very nice person. I don't think that she's a bad person. In fact, I actually enjoyed the engagement that we had on Twitter. I thought it was a good back and forth, and I appreciated it because she has about 200,000 more followers than I do, which means she either has a million and I have 800,000, or we just don't need to talk about what that math actually equates to. But anyway, she engaged, and I was a little spicy. I'll admit, I was a little bit, you know, I don't have red hair, but I can imagine somebody who read my tweet probably thought I did. But anyway, she writes, I don't care that Lizzo, who is a really talented flutist, played an old flute because I didn't even know James Madison had one. I guarantee you didn't either. And I replied, "Your grammar is horrible." I'm just kidding. I didn't say that. I said, "This is not a good argument. Does something's value depend on your knowledge of it? No. Your ignorance does not determine the value of the object or action, but rather the value of your argument." That was where I put the burn, you know? Like, boom. You know, that's some rhetoric right there. "A disease you don't know about can still kill you. Actions like this show a dying society." And so she responded, "And what exactly is the historical significance of to the country of this flute besides the fact that a government official once owned it?" Well, therein lies the problem, right there. And all you had to do was go to Wikipedia to figure it out. But we'll address that in a minute. If you followed the Lizzo flute thing, which is really more of a cultural story than anything else, it has a lot of different problems associated with it. Most people were saying, well, you know, you didn't know about it, like Morgan here says, you know, you didn't know about it, so why do you care now? Obviously, if you didn't know about it, it's not important, which is just fallacious. That's just not true on any level, on things of value or things of danger, like at all. Number two is that people objected and said, so you're just saying that, well, because it's old, it's valuable? No, that is not what we are saying. At the end of the day, there's a lot of things that make something valuable, and we'll get into those. And then third, they were saying, you know, that this is insignificant, and it's not insignificant, as we will see. And if you've been reading along in our book club on the Captive Mind, you'll understand why things like this are not merely, oh, nothing to worry about, it's not a symptom of anything, it's just what us Thomas might say, accidental to the nature of the country. It is not accidental to the revolution, however, which is what we are currently in. And the Captive Mind, again, reiterates this. So we're going to go through these little objections one by one. I'm just going to kind of go through them real quickly. And then we're going to get into a little bit of closing out Miloš's book on the Captive Mind, the last two chapters. And there'll be some overlap here between the two. So number one, is something not valuable because you don't know about it? Well, let me ask you a question. If you had a long-lost twin brother that you didn't know about, and somebody killed them, would that make you sad that you found out that you had a brother you never knew? Especially if he was on his way to visit you and you were going to meet him and he got into a car accident because he was actually like a super assassin and somebody took him out. And now you never get to know him, but now you know he existed. Well, obviously the fact that you didn't know that he existed didn't change the value of his life. That's like saying that, you know, when there are people over in Africa, because I don't know their names, the fact that they are dying from plague or famine or any of these things that can come through Africa or supply chain issues or COVID or any of those things, that their lives don't matter because I don't know their name. That's just absurd, which is the primary argument that she's making. So right off the bat, she's just wrong. And again, Morgan is probably a very nice person. No offense, Morgan. You know, we can still be friends, although I don't know that we're actually friends. I think I'm following you now, but you're probably not even listening to this, so that doesn't matter. But number two is that at the end of the day, and Matt Walsh made this argument too, which I was happy with because I was making it on Twitter before he made it on a show, as far as I know. Well, at least I didn't listen to it until after. But he says too, you know, there are museums full of things that we don't know about that are totally valuable. So this is just absurd on its face. Also, a whistle or a flute is not as valuable as James Madison's whistle or flute. You could just go and try and pay for a flute or a whistle somewhere else, and it's not going to be the same price as Madison's flute. Like, that's the problem with this. Even just quantitatively, if somebody gave you a flute from Walmart or they gave you James Madison's flute, which one do you want? Which one are you going to sell on eBay, right? You just know that one of those is better than the other one. So from just a economic standpoint, we understand that historical relics have value. But they're not just valuable because they're old. They're valuable because of the context that they represent. Something isn't valuable because it's old. This comes into the objection number two. Something's not valuable simply because it is old. You could go to Pikes Peak, for example, in Colorado Springs, where I used to live, and you could go to the top and grab a rock off the top of that mountain. It's old. It's older than you. It's older than your parents. It's probably older than this country. It's not going to be valuable because it's a rock. But if Elvis Presley met you at the top of Pikes Peak and you asked him for his autograph, that rock now is going to have some value. Now, it might not have value to Morgan, but it is going to have value in the general scheme of things because why? Elvis Presley had influence on the human experience in America through rock and roll or whatever. So obviously, when a figure has an impact on how an entire generation thinks or behaves, or maybe how the entire world behaves. Somebody like James Madison, who, according to his Wikipedia page, so you know it's true, is the father of the Constitution. Yep, just a government official there. Yep, he's just a DMV employee. He's just helping you get a license. Madison is hailed as the father of the Constitution for his pivotal role in drafting and promoting the Constitution of the United States and the Bill of Rights. So, probably not merely a government official, just saying. At the end of the day, the reason why this flute is valuable is because of the fact that it was owned by James Madison. And we understand this too. I could go into a jewelry store and buy a wedding ring for my wife, and that ring is going to be more important to her than your wife's wedding ring. Why? Because it's her wedding ring. Now, she might think that the diamond is nicer than yours or something like that, but that wedding ring is tied to an event. That event is priceless. And the person who's wearing that ring is priceless. And it's associated to our family line. And if my kids become some sort of famous person who changes the world, my wife's ring is going to be worth more money because they're going to say, this was the mother of such and such's kids. And this is her wedding ring. Because at the end of the day, human actions are deserving of honor and respect. They may not get us salvation. They may not make us into a Christian or any of those kinds of things. But to say that human beings don't do incredible things and therefore end up conferring incredible value around the things that they touch is just absurd. I mean, this is obviously true in the Midas, King Midas story. You know, everything he touches turns to gold. This ends up becoming a vice for him. But obviously there are people out there who whatever they touch ends up having some sort of value. And this ends up also being a curse for them. Now, that's a side trail. But the point is that just because something is old doesn't mean it's valuable. The nature of the thing is what matters. This isn't merely a flute. This is a piece of historical American legacy. America is the greatest country that ever lived. What the founders were doing at the time is an incredible accomplishment in human history. And James Madison was at the forefront of that. And this is his flute. And so now the third thing comes to, well, does it really matter whoever gets to touch this thing, whoever gets to use it and play it? Does that really matter? I mean, after all, Lizzo's a very good flautist, apparently. So does it really matter? Well, yeah, it does matter because when we give people an honor, we are saying that what they represent is honorable. And so imagine if we had given this flute to, say, I don't know, let's just suppose, and I'm not saying Lizzo's like Hitler, I'm just saying, let's suppose that we gave the flute to somebody who was a white supremacist and hated black people, and we said, we want you to play this flute. Well, we would probably, as a country, be pretty appalled at that. Now, that doesn't mean that Lizzo is the equivalent of a white supremacist. However, she does seem to support organizations that may at times cross a line of saying, you know, there are certain races, black people may be better than others. That does seem to be some of the things that are being said in the BLM movement. However, when she's playing the flute, it doesn't even matter that stuff. If we look at the kind of lifestyle that Lizzo promotes, it doesn't matter if she loves America or not. She's not a person that we should try to emulate if she's going to go around and say it's a virtuous thing to be obese. It's a virtuous thing to be walking around half naked on a stage, and then to continue that idea that she'd be playing the flute in this state. So Lizzo's quote after she played this flute, which apparently she did pretty well, but that doesn't matter, was, "Bitch, I just twerked and played James Madison's crystal flute from the 1800s. She said incredulously, "We just made history tonight." So is this somebody that is respectful or honorable, or somebody that we want to actually our children to emulate, or that does the behavior or the virtues that she has actually represent what makes a country strong? Well, generally speaking, this kind of is the, well, if everybody did it, would it be good? Well, no. That doesn't mean that that applies in every instance, but when we're talking about virtues, it does. If everybody, for example, doesn't steal, isn't that a better society? Well, yeah, we would say that's a better society. But if we said, well, if everybody didn't eat meat, is that a better society? Well, no, because some people might need meat. They might need it in order to actually be the best version of a human being that they could be. So the fact that Lizzo is not, you know, a gun-toting patriotic American is not what qualifies her for being able to play this flute. The point is that this was a public privilege that should be reserved for people that we believe are the best representation of what it means to be an upstanding citizen. If Lizzo is that, then I think we can all agree we might be veering off. I don't think that this in and of itself is indicative that America is going down the Marxist route. But as we see in Miwosh's book, The Captive Mind, communism and Marxism is a very, very complicated thing when it comes into a society. We often think about it in terms of a top-down approach. And the reason why I'm going here is because this is where the thread went. I made the comment on the thread that this is a Marxist kind of approach, or a Marxist effect, rather. I should have probably said that in the thread, but I probably didn't do as good of a job. But the point is that it's a Marxist effect on society, because what is happening, as Miwosh says, is that communists seek mastery over the mind, but they don't just come in as a Stalin. It's not like you wake up one day and Stalin's there. Now that might be what it feels like to some people, but that's not how it happens historically. What happens is that they first have to slowly move in a revolutionary seed, basically, an idea that the old is dead and needs to pass away, and a new needs to come into being. And so we see this in communism throughout the book, The Captive Mind. When those that are part of the new faith, to use Miwosh's words, are praised for being overweight, half naked, and supporters of Marxist groups and ideologies, this is a reformative act of culture. What we're saying is that when we give this flute to somebody, that it's a ceremony of honor. And we are saying that all of the things that this person represents, whether we mean it or not, that's how it's received by the culture. The next generation says, so I guess if I'm like Lizzo, I could play that flute too. Or I guess if I'm like Cardi B, maybe I could do something with Lizzo too. And if we look at what these kinds of individuals are pushing, we would say, well, this is problematic. And so let's look at Miwosh real quick. He says on page 197, he says, "Everything thus takes us back to the question of mastery over the mind. Every possible opportunity for education and advancement is offered to the more energetic and active individuals among the workers. The new, incredibly extensive bureaucracy is recruited from among the young people of working class origin. The road before them is open but guarded. Their thinking must be based on the firm principles of dialectical materialism, or the philosophy undergirding communism. Schools, theaters, films, painting, literature, and the press all shape their thinking." I'm going to say that one more time. Schools, theaters, films, painting, literature, and the press all shape their thinking. What Miwosh is saying here is that what these things do are the method with which the communists are able to shape men's minds. And one of the things that is a problem with the superficial knowledge of communism is that we often see it in its final form, in movies or in books, we don't see a lot of movies made about, you know, an HBO series, for example, of starting with Hitler when he was 5 years old and seeing how he grew up and the history of Germany as it kind of percolated around this idea of fascism and how it came through World War I and the Treaty of Versailles and all those things. We just want World War II, Saving Private Ryan, and another Call of Duty game. That's basically what we want. And so we don't see the way in which these ideas progress in the culture. And one of the things that's important with communism is to understand the way that it works. So on page 202, a man's subconscious, it's actually on 201 is where it starts. A man's subconscious or not quite conscious life is richer than his vocabulary. His opposition to this new philosophy of life is much like a toothache. Not only can he not express the pain in words, but he cannot even tell you which tooth is aching. Now, before we go on, let's just translate that for a minute. What he's saying here is that people know something's wrong, but they can't really describe it. They know something's off, but they can't really describe it. If you were to go to Lizzo, for example, and say, "Do you believe in Marxism?" She'd be like, "No, I'm an American," probably. She probably would say something like that. If you asked her, well, do you believe that, you know, in victim status and that people should be raised up and that the people who are really keeping everybody down are the wealthy in this country, the one percenters, the middle class, you know, she would probably say, well, yeah, I do agree with that. If you were to say, do you think that maybe there's that you should have merits, that people should be praised based on the fact that they're healthy and successful and that they're modest and that they're this or that, she'll say, because I saw it in the quotes in some of her articles, no, you shouldn't put people into a box. Anybody can be what they want to be, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the problem with Marxism and communism is that it doesn't necessarily come in under those names. It redefines things. And then when things have been sufficiently redefined, that's when it makes its revelation known to the people. So continuing on, thanks to the excellent means of vulgarization, unprepared people, i.e. those minds who work feebly, are taught to reason. Their training convinces them that what is happening in the people's democracies is necessary. That's communism. Even if temporarily bad, the greater the number of people who participate in culture, i.e. pass through the schools, read books and magazines, attend theaters and exhibitions, the further the doctrine reaches and the smaller grows the threat to the rule of philosophers. They are impervious. According to the party, if these people were clearly aware of their situation, they would have to confess that there is no hope for them. Therefore, they look for mental subterfuges or places they can hide. Those people are enemies. They must be ejected to the margins of society, not because of what they do, but because of what they are. Despite the fact that their intentions may be subjectively good, their guilt has an objective character. And so he proceeds on, and he continues to talk about this on page 211. He says this. And again, what I'm trying to say here, just before I read this quote, is that this stuff comes in subtly. And so when somebody's like, well, she didn't say she was a Marxist, so why are you saying that it's a Marxist thing? It's like, because that's never how it happens. Anybody who reads The Captive Mind or reads Solzhenitsyn or anything, there are certain and very, or the Black Book of Communism, for example, there are specific sociological factors that align, that make something like communism or fascism something to be aimed at by the society. And so it's not merely that a strong man comes in, like people would like to say with Trump. There has to be some level at which people are pitted against each other, as we'll see in the later chapters, later discussions on the book itself. But right now we're talking about how this whole situation with Lizzo works out. So on page 211, he says this regarding Christianity. The transition from Christianity to a cult of history takes place imperceptibly. Without a doubt, the greatest success of the Imperium would be if it could install a party-line pope in the Vatican. A mass in the Basilica of St. Peter in Rome, performed by such a pope with the assistance of dignitaries from those subjugated countries which are predominantly Catholic, would be one of the most important steps toward the consolidation of the world empire. The key word here is imperceptibly. It comes in under this small, unnoticeable, actions, because the moment you say something like, hey, I don't think Lizzo should play that flute, they say, well, what's the big deal? It's not that big of a deal. It's just a flute, man. It's just a flute. And later on in this thread, she responded to me and said, communists and Marxist survivors, what do they have to do with this flute? And it's like, well, that's kind of the point of reading history, is because the survivors of these things help you see things you otherwise wouldn't see, because they said the same things you're saying right now, and they were wrong. And so the survivors are the ones who tell you, hey, what she's doing with that flute, it actually matters. And if you were to respond with, well, it's just a flute, they would say, you're a moron. And you should look at the people and the devastation that this happened. At some point, Miwosh says in here, imagined disaster is never as bad as real disaster. And he says, the problem with the West is that they've never actually seen cities completely leveled where there's no living thing. Literally no living thing. So we come in on page 211, where he says, oh, we already read that. So then we go on to 216. And on 216, this one I even wrote flute in the margin. Yes, if the literature of socialist realism is useful, it is so only to the party. It is supposed to present reality not as a man sees it, but as he understands it. Understanding that reality is in motion, and that in every phenomenon what is being born and what is dying exists simultaneously. Dialectically speaking, this is the battle between the new and the old. In our context, Lizzo would be the new, and the old would be James Madison. The author should praise everything that is budding and censor everything that is becoming the past. In practice, this means that the author should perceive elements of the class struggle in every phenomenon. Carrying this reason further, the doctrine forces all art to become didactic, since only the Stalinists have the right to represent the proletariat, which is the rising class. Everything that is new and therefore praiseworthy results from party strategy and tactics. Socialist realism depends on an identification of the new with the proletariat and the proletariat with the party. Eventually, they must, according to which tendencies are stronger in them, land in one camp or the other. When literature is not dealing with prefabricated figures of friends and foes, it studies the process of metamorphosis by which men arrive at total salvation or absolute damnation in party terms. So the question here is, are James Madison and Lizzo aligned? Do they have the same values? I highly, highly doubt that. And so one last description here is that in, there's two. There's one that he gives a story of a caterpillar. And he says, there is a species of insect which injects its venom into a caterpillar. Thus inoculated, the caterpillar lives on, though it is paralyzed. The poisonous insect then lays its eggs in it, and the body of the caterpillar serves as a living larder for the young brood. Just so, though Marx and Engels never foresaw this use of their doctrine, the anesthetic of dialectical materialism is injected into the mind of a man in the people's democracies. When his brain is duly paralyzed, the eggs of Stalinism are laid in it. As soon as you are a Marxist, the party says to the patient, you must be a Stalinist, for there is no Marxism outside of Stalinism. They fail to consider that the very course of history leads people to think about the subject matter of these works, meaning Marxists and Engels. So at the end of the day, this stuff moves incredibly slow. It works its way in like an insect poisoning a living thing and then using that society as a parasite would in order to fester and create its own political ideologies. And so the last thing that I was going to say on this, lest people think that this is just, you know, well, it's just accidental. You know, these stages don't really matter. The fact that we've had, you know, revolutions and stuff, we had a summer of rioting. We now have transgenderism. I mean, we're literally changing what it means to be a man and a woman, the most fundamental basis of any society that has ever existed on the planet. And anybody who's challenged those ideologies has not really been around long. When you say women can't have kids, you know, or that they don't need to, you know, your society doesn't exactly stick around for very much longer. But on page 244, he says, the stages are measured out in advance, and they succeed each other with mathematical precision. The only interest lies in watching the reactions of the human material. Human material seems to have one major defect, though. It does not like to be considered merely as human material. It finds it hard to endure the feeling that it must resign itself to passive acceptance of changes introduced from above. And so when we look at what this whole thing about the flute is, some might say, well, just because you didn't know about it, so it's not valuable. It's like, well, that doesn't matter, because at the end of the day, there's a lot of things that are valuable that you don't know about. And if you just think about it for a minute, you know, what's in the Smithsonian? Is the stuff in there not valuable? Come on, tell me, give me the inventory right now. I mean, if it's valuable, you got to know about it, which was the primary response that she had. And then number two, something is not valuable because it's old. This is obviously false. We don't give something value simply because it's old. We give it value because of what it represents and where it comes from. And the fact of the matter is, James Madison is a founding father. He is a drafter of the Constitution. He has a significant role in what America represents. And even if Lizzo was a, you know, redneck, beer-drinking, gun-toting American who, you know, loves to just go around and be redneck and destroy things and just all this crazy stuff, we would still say, well, you know, that's not what America represents. Like, that's not what we want to be about. But my point is that this person doesn't have to be, you know, a prepper or something like that. That still would be somebody that we would say, well, hold on a second. Like, maybe this isn't exactly what we want America to be. Or maybe if it was like this, you know, beautiful model or something like that, like, you know, Pamela Anderson or something like that. Like, I wouldn't necessarily call her beautiful, but you know, you get the point. Like, if we decided to put a sex icon up there to play James Madison's flute, that would say something bad about our culture. And this is, again, not to say that Lizzo is just like all these other things. It's just saying that what we do when we honor somebody with these kinds of activities, it says something about what we as a culture, or what our authorities who are supposed to guard these things, say about what is virtuous and what is good. And Lizzo has openly said that being fat is nothing that you need to change, which doctors and medical science and would disagree with. And number two, that she parades around half naked and objectifies and shows women that they can be promiscuous, and that there's nothing wrong with that. None of these things are actually good. Doesn't mean that Lizzo has to be perfect to play the flute. It just means that when we talk about somebody as far as what they represent in the public sphere, what they promote, we should ask ourselves, is this what we want our children and our country to promote? And if the answer is no, then she shouldn't play the flute. That's it. So moving on to Milosh and wrapping up this segment, we're going into the book club segment. So Man the Enemy is the next chapter that we are coming into. And there was a chapter on one more of his friends, Delta, but ultimately the big gist that you get out of that is Delta is a nonconformist. And, you know, you think of your friend who just always is going against the grain. He's kind of a troublemaker. Think of your friend who's always like getting into trouble in college or high school, and he's writing funny papers. He's making stuff up and still getting A's, and he's kind of just a jokester. Well, Delta is that. And Miwosh says Delta was a nonconformist, which is why it was so surprising that he decided to buy into the ideology and he became a communist. So at the end of the day, what Miwosh is trying to say in that chapter is the power of this apparatus, this communism, was so powerful that even those that were by nature nonconformist in a normal situation submitted and complied and became something nobody ever thought they would become. And this is a theme throughout the book, right? The plasticity of human nature that the West does not understand. They don't understand how much man is willing to change in order to save his own skin, and the things he's willing to do in order to preserve himself. The power over the church, that is the theme in Man the Enemy. And there are a lot of very interesting sociological factors in this chapter, such as lack of skilled labor, co-workers reporting on each other, the kind of psychological atmosphere that this creates. But there are two major, well, really three major things that you should draw out of this chapter. Number one is the Orwellian view that is laced throughout this chapter, which is not 2 + 2 = 4. It is 2 × 2 = 4. And this is really interesting how he flips this on its head in a way that normally isn't talked about today. The second thing is Christianity and its complacency. Christian universities show up here. If you're reading this chapter, you start to see how Christian universities, which I won't name here, but you can go look them up. Just pick your favorite Christian university and type in that school and diversity, equity, and inclusion, and you will see that they have a department. Usually it's under the label of Kingdom Diversity, and they dress it up in a bunch of Christian language and stuff. But I will say this. A lot of these schools are fundamentalist schools, meaning they disagree with materialism. But the irony is that by participating in DEI, is that they are actually advocating for a materialist political philosophy. So we'll get into that. And then finally, currency changes, but markets do not. And we will talk about these three things. So the first thing that we're going to talk about is the power over the church and how this came about into the communist framework. So if we go on to page 212, we see this. This is one of the most prescient comments in the entire book. The masses in highly industrialized countries like England, the United States, or France are largely de-Christianized. Technology and the way of life it produces undermines Christianity far more effectively than do violent measures. The erosion of religious beliefs is also taking place in Central and Eastern Europe. Before we continue on, one of the things that is really, really interesting about this is if you look around, what do you see in your churches? The one thing that has come into churches constantly throughout history is the upgrade of technology. Technology has a massive influence. And when you talk about an imperceptible change, just think about what it used to be like before cell phones, if you can remember that. If you're younger and you don't remember that, then I'm sorry. It was a good time. But the way that human beings think about the world is very, very different now. There is a lot of isolationism, and there's a lot of a desire for safetyism. People are scared to go out. People are scared of dying. There's a lot of anxiety. And a large part of this is because we've been able to make the world so, quote unquote, safe. Now, I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing, but the point is that technology fundamentally changes how we view the world. And this is not something that should be taken lightly. If you read C.S. Lewis, Hannah Arendt, Miwosh as well, we're going to read Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. I'm sure he's going to get into some technology in that book. At the end of the day, technology has an influence on our theology. And anybody who's studied church history knows that as well because of the telescopes and when we started figuring out that we weren't the center of the universe, et cetera, et cetera. But Miwosh is going to say things here more than he realized. So keep in mind, he's saying technology undermines Christianity far more effectively than do violent measures. And the other thing you have to remember is that Christianity is public enemy number one for the communists. That's what he says, public enemy number one. It is the thing that communism has to destroy, because if it doesn't, then there will always be a potential for Christians to realize that they are worshiping, or citizens to realize that they are worshiping something they should not, mainly the state or the leader of the state, and they are treating their neighbors the way that God says not to treat them. So we continue on. There, the core of the problem is to avoid galvanizing the forces of Christianity by some careless misstep. It would be an act of unforgivable carelessness, for example, to close the churches suddenly and prohibit all religious practice. Oh, geez, that's never happened before, right? Oh, wait, 2020. Yeah, worst year ever. Part of the clergy must be compromised as reactionaries and foreign agents, a rather easy task, given the utterly conservative mentality of many priests. The other part must be bound to the state as closely as the Orthodox Church is in Russia, so that it becomes a tool of the government. A completely submissive church, one that may on occasion collaborate with the security police, loses authority in the eyes of the pious. Such a church can be preserved for decades until the moment when it dies a natural death due to a lack of adherence. So there are measures that can be taken even against the church, this last stronghold of opposition. So the church is the last defense, according to Miwosh. But before we get onto that, I want to point out technology does subvert the church, and it did so even more than Miwosh could have predicted. In 2020, we shut down all of the churches. And commentators were saying, especially boomers, were saying, well, you know, if they try to do that, the churches are going to revolt. They're not going to do that. They care too much about their about God and their worship and stuff. But what happened? Well, we'll just Zoom our church services. We'll just get online and we'll just do church online. Which, of course, we understand, you know, going and doing stuff online together in your on your computer is nowhere near as good as doing it in person. And yet we all just stepped in line. The accomplishment of shutting down all the churches globally, by the way, this is unprecedented. And it is demonstrative of the fact that these countries have done something that even the communists in some of these most the darkest churches did not want to attempt. And we attempted it and succeeded. Now, if that's not a warning to the current climate of where we're in, then I don't know what's going to wake you up. Right here, you have Miwosh talking about Poland and talking about the fact that you should not misstep. If you shut down all the churches at once, they revolt overnight. Well, if they do it again, do you think that that's going to make a difference? Do you think people are going to shout at the rooftops and protest and go out there and say, you know, we want our churches back open? I don't think so. In fact, you actually had a lot of Christians saying, well, we've got to do this because of Romans 13. We've got to do this because Peter says to honor the kings and authorities. But there was no discussion of what it means to suffer for the good. There was no discussion about the impact that it's going to have on the church when they decide to shut down their healing services, while at the same time, you know, saying, well, we can't heal COVID, but, you know, when it goes away, we'll start to pray for you to be able to walk again. Now, if this doesn't show hypocrisy, you know, then you're just not paying attention. This obviously should cause people to question whether or not their churches are authentic. Because if in history, the fear that communists had was shutting down all the churches, and we were able to pull that off, our government was able to pull that off, and the churches just went along with it, and any Christian who said, well, I think this is wrong, got the Bible thrown at them, had communion withheld from them, were ostracized by many of their congregants, well, those pastors need to understand that they are participating in that second group, that group that becomes a tool of the government. And again, we've talked about it on this show before. Megan Basham did a great article on this about the government using evangelicals to push a narrative around the vaccine. And so when we look at this, we have to understand that this was a huge, huge, incredible success because it happened globally. And you can read about the court cases that were fought around the world for churches to be able to remain open when they were mistreated for trying to practice their faith during COVID. And this demonstrates how a submissive church is a dangerous church. We are to submit to God. And this is why I think people like James Lindsay are trying to wake the church up. It's because I think, and I could be wrong, you know, hopefully we can get him on the show at some point and I can just ask him to his face. But I think that there's a level at which he understands if he's reading the same stuff we're reading, well, oh shoot, like the Christians are the answer to this. And everybody who's gone through this actually knows that. So when we look at, so how strong is this? Like when we talk about the Orwellian stuff, when we talk about this, you know, a lot of times we talk about 2 + 2 = 4 and all this kind of jazz. Well, he's going to get into the idea of 2 × 2 = 4. And it's important to understand what he's trying to say. During this section, he is saying that when somebody goes through the method and they start to get brainwashed, they will believe lies as if those lies are as true as 2 × 2 = 4. when you're reading Orwell, he says, you know, we can say 2 + 2 = 5 and you will not disagree. So Miwosh kind of says the same thing, just differently. He says, no, they'll believe the lie as if it's as true as 2 + 2 = 4, which is just a little bit nuanced, but it's different. He says, the son of a worker subjected to such an education cannot think otherwise than as the school demands. 2 × 2 = 4. The press, literature, painting, films, and theater all illustrate what he learns, just as the lives of saints and martyrs serve as illustrations of theology. It would be wrong to assert that a dual set of values no longer exists. A man's subconscious or not quite conscious life is richer than his vocabulary. His opposition to this new philosophy of life is much like a toothache. Not only can he not express the pain in words, but he cannot even tell you which tooth is aching. And so this is where Miwosh is trying to show you the strength of the method on the psychology of the next generation. And they do not care about the older generation. I'm not going to give you the quote, but there are plenty of quotes where he says that the communists don't care about the old guys because they can't do anything because they're old and they're going to die off eventually anyway. As we continue on, we find that there are examples of taking advantage of Christianity and its redemptive streak and also trying to reform it in the image of communism. It says, I have known many Christians, Poles, Frenchmen, Spaniards, who were strict Stalinists in the field of politics, but who retained certain inner reservations, believing God would make corrections once the bloody sentences of the Almighties of history were carried out. They pushed their reasoning rather far. They argue that history develops according to immutable laws that exist by the will of God. One of these laws is the class struggle. Stalin, the leader of the Communist Party, fulfills the law of history, or in other words, acts by the will of God. Therefore, one must obey him. Mankind can be renewed only on the Russian pattern. That is why no Christian can oppose the one cruel, it is true, idea which will create a new kind of man over the entire planet. Such reasoning is often used by clerics who are party tools. Christ is a new man. The new man is the Soviet man. Therefore, Christ is a Soviet man, said Justinian Marina, the Romanian patriarch. Marina is an extreme example, but I don't have to use him as an example. We can use the guys who are just going along to get along. These are the priests. In reality, such Christians perpetuate one of the greatest lies of all centuries. They renounce their faith, but are ashamed to admit it. The contradiction between Christianity and Stalinist philosophy cannot be overcome. Christianity is based on a concept of individual merit and guilt, the new faith on historical merit and guilt. The Christian who rejects individual merit and guilt denies the work of Jesus, and the God he calls upon slowly transforms himself into history. If he admits that only individual merit and guilt exist, how can he gaze indifferently at the suffering of people whose only sin was that they blocked the path of historical processes? And what did Lizzo say? We just made history, bitch. That's what she said. To lull his conscience, this man resorts to the thesis that a reactionary cannot be a good man. And a reactionary, for Miwosh, is a common sense person. Somebody who says, something's not right here, but if they say anything, they're going to get in trouble. So there was a school that set up a struggle session that's a Christian university that, I don't know, maybe I'll do a blog post responding to it, but it was Cedarville University that had a white student talking with a black professor. They were talking about the historical guilt that white people have in America. And these are happening around Christian universities. And you're seeing this happen among Christian intellectuals saying, you know, well, we need to really come in and see it from their perspective, and we need to understand this. But they don't understand is that a lot of the people pushing this idea of diversity, equity, and inclusion are doing this on without realizing it. They are pushing a Marxist ideology. Some people know it, like the BLM founders admit that they are Marxists. So at the end of the day, when we look at this ideology, it comes in incredibly, incredibly subtly. If you do not know about it, you know, you will not understand it. And we actually have people who survived. I mean, when you read about how horrible these systems were. The fact that brilliant men like Miłosz came out of this stuff, and we have their books, and we're watching this in real time. Some people are starting to see this happen in real time, and they're starting to realize, like, hey, there's some parallels here. Now, that doesn't mean that we're guaranteed to go down this road. We still could stop it. We could. Who knows what the future is going to hold? But the reality remains that these are communist ideas, and the more you read about it, the more it's impossible not to see it. And this gets into the last point of currency changes, but markets don't. On page 209, he says, the pressure of an all-powerful totalitarian state creates an emotional tension in its citizens that determines their acts. When people are divided into loyalists and criminals, a premium is placed on every type of conformist, coward, and hireling. Whereas among the criminals, one finds a singularly high percentage of people who are direct, sincere, and true to themselves. From the social point of view, these persons would constitute the best guarantee that the future of the social organism would be toward good. From the Christian point of view, they have no other sin on their conscience save their contempt for Caesar or their incorrect evaluation of his might. So when he says a premium is placed on every type of conformist, coward, and hireling, whereas among the criminals one finds a singularly high percentage of people who are direct, sincere, or true to themselves, one of the things that we underestimate is the idea that freedom has a cost. In one sense, you're never not free. And, you know, anybody who survived communism or fled communism or anything would probably mock me for saying this. But it's merely just an intellectual observation. It doesn't necessarily have any emotional appeal. But it does offer some level of understanding of what's going on. When you are in these societies, from my perspective, reading the testimonies of Miłosz and Solzhenitsyn, you can go along and that costs you something. Or you can choose not to go along and that will cost you something. It will have a physical effect on your life. It might even have a monetary effect on your life. What's happened is not that the free market has somehow gone away. What has happened is that the government has come in and changed the exchange of and the currency that we use. Now, instead of money to decide what you want or to buy or whatever, now it's your loyalty. It's your conformity that is the currency. The more you conform, the higher up you go. And most of the time when we look at these books or we watch these movies, what we're talking about or what we're reading about is not something what we're experiencing is not what actually happened. In our movies, we oftentimes have these portrayed dark scenes where we're watching the fallout of Stalinism or communism or Hitler and fascism. We're watching Berlin walls fall and we're watching all this stuff. What we don't realize is that society did, for the most part, continue on for 90% of the people. They were able to go to grocery stores. They were able to buy things. They were able to have their, you know, lives paid for by the government. And it wasn't great. It kind of sucked. It wasn't like all of a sudden everything was destroyed. Everything was broken down buildings and all this kind of stuff. In Solzhenitsyn's In the First Circle, he recounts this. One of the guys comes out of the gulag for the first time to go talk to the boss. And on his way there, he's expecting to see buildings and destruction and people just in poverty. And he's shocked because they don't know that he's in the gulag. And he doesn't realize how much the city has grown and prospered. So when people say, well, communism doesn't work, it's like, well, yeah, it depends on what you mean by work. It's kind of like buying a gas guzzler when you need an economy vehicle. It'll get you to where maybe the leaders want to go, but you're going to use a lot of citizens and humans to get there, and you're going to guzzle them. Whereas in America, we're able to do it efficiently. We're able to do it virtuously for the most part. And you can live a life, even if you've got some of the most corrupt, powerful people in the world, you can still live a life that is, for the most part, free. But at the end of the day, in these countries, that currency of freedom can change real quick. And it can be, well, you give us your life or we take your life. And that's how the currency changes. The market is still there. You're still exchanging something. It's just not money. It's just not your labor. It's your loyalty. It's your worship. And this is what leads us to the last chapter, which is the humanization of Milosz. And one of the things he says here in this last chapter, and again, if you can't read this whole book, I understand it's a dark book. It's difficult. I would really recommend you read the last two chapters. You don't have to read these chapters sequentially. You can read them individually, like little essays. The last two chapters are the most relevant for the time that we're in, not just in America, but globally, I think. But on 233, he drives home this idea that communism really tries to pit man against man. He says, the question arises as to whether or not one is allowed to destroy three such creatures in the name of higher ends. The Stalinists will answer that it is allowed. Christians and pseudo-Christians will answer that it is not. Neither the former nor the latter are entirely consistent. 90% of the arguments used by Stalinists in their propaganda are based on man's injury of man. And if we look at some of these articles about Lizzo, to kind of come back to that for a second, she is angry at people for calling her overweight. She is angry at people for criticizing her. And she uses that, as Milosz says, that hatred, that anger that comes from feeling like your fellow citizen is against you, is precisely the psychological apparatus that the center or the authoritarians need in order to further their revolution. And so we see in this whole entire book that the main themes of communism are hatred of each other and worship of the state. It's very interesting that God says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and love your neighbor as yourself. Communism says, love the state with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and hate your neighbor. That's what it says. Because that's the fuel that it needs in order to keep the fire going. And what it ends up saying, what Milosz says, is that they have to do this because they know that if just 1%, and he says this explicitly, if just 1% were to push back, they would lose everything. And they know this. And Milosz continues on, and he's talking about the darkness of what happened in the Baltic states, the lesson of the Baltics. And there's some sections you can kind of skip in here because they're contextual. But for the most part, everything is very, very, very good. And before I read this next session, I just want to ask, you know, have you ever talked to somebody about what's going on these days? And they'll say, we're living in a different time, or the way they did it in the old days, but we just don't do it that way anymore. And the way that they say it is kind of just accepting. I was talking with the CEO of a company, and I was explaining some of the challenges I was having at one of my jobs of people coming in and pushing woke ideologies. And I was confident that this individual was going to be on my side with some of the things. And he informed me that he was actually pushing a lot of those same things himself. And these are Marxist ideas. And he said, well, we're just living in a different time. Really? Just living in a different time? We're gonna start censoring employees. We're gonna start doing minutia checks on people, which is what we were talking about. Or maybe government officials who talk about, you know, back in the day when the military used to respect Christianity as a religion for the soldiers, and that, you know, they kept it in high regard. Have you ever heard of a high up? Well, you know, I don't want to lose my promotion. You know, I got to make sure, you know, I keep my head down, you know, update my LinkedIn. We are living in a different time, but the question is, what are we going to do to make sure that that isn't a dark time? And that is our generation's responsibility, whether you're a boomer, whether you're a Gen Xer, whether you're a millennial, whether you're a Generation Z or a Zillennial or whatever. You know, they're running out of generations. That's got to be a sign that the end times are coming, you know? Like, we don't have any more generations we can use. So, you know, Jesus has got to be coming back, you know? Started with A, the apostles, you know, and then it went to, you know, bishops, you know, the B, and then it went to clergy, the C. Now we're on millennials and you know, Z, we're in trouble. But this is one of the things that Miłosz talks about as he's discussing this. He is trying to help people understand, well, in this last chapter, well, what are we actually supposed to do? And as an artist, he has a specific role. Other people who aren't artists, they have specific roles. But for him, he's going to take us down a different road. But before he gets us there, he's going to talk about the fear and what it does. And so when we talk about people who are saying, well, we just live in a different time, or you see a soldier or you see a military person or somebody saying, well, you know, I'm just punching the clock. You know, these FBI agents who are just doing what they're told, you know, just arresting pro-life citizens. Well, Miłosz would say this. A long period of terror demands an established apparatus and becomes a permanent institution. Deportees may try to escape. Their relatives can scarcely approve of their disappearance, and it is indicated that they be put on the next list. The families of these relatives are an uncertain element which can be kept in line only under threat. Only fear can inspire diligence in dissatisfied peasants tied to collectives. When they decide to go through your code or check your email statements to make sure you're using racially sensitive language, are you complying because, you know, you're just trying to be nice, or are you complying because of fear? When they force a vaccine on you, are you complying because, you know, you just don't want to rock the boat, or is it because you're afraid of what'll happen if you do? Fear is the cement that centralizes power. And Miłosz continues, and he says, fear is well known as a cement of societies. In the liberal capitalist economy, fear of lack of money, fear of losing one's job, fear of slipping down one rung on the social ladder, all spur the individual to greater effort. But what exists in the Imperium is naked fear. In a capitalist city with a population of 100,000 people, some 10,000, let us say, may have been haunted by fear of unemployment. Such fear appeared to them to be a personal situation, tragic in the view of the indifference and callousness of their environment. But if all 100,000 people live in daily fear, they give off a collective aura that hangs over the city like a heavy cloud. Gold alienates man from himself. Naked fear, which has replaced capital, alienates him even more efficiently. To transcend this fear, new means must be devised. One must breed a new man, one for whom work will be a joy and a pride instead of a curse of Adam. Miłosz is trying to show you that fear is going to be in both societies. You're going to have it in both. The question you have to ask yourself is, why are you complying? Is it because of wisdom, or is it because of fear? You're the only one who can answer that question. But whether it is your job, your church, your community, whatever it may be, we are all headed for a time in which we are all going to have to make a choice between our conscience and the state. That's where we're headed. No one's going to escape that. Some people might not necessarily be directly approached. Some people are not being investigated by the FBI right now, for example. But what about the families and friends of those people who are being investigated by the FBI, the pro-lifers? What about them? You think their friends are sticking with them? If they do, aren't they going to possibly get investigated by the FBI? Even if they don't come knocking on your door, you still will have to make a decision about whether or not you're going to help somebody who is found in the crosshairs of government totalitarianism and tyranny. And God knows how long this will be, but hopefully it's very short-lived, and hopefully things change very, very quickly. But in closing, there is one quote that I think is helpful as we kind of close this out. Some of you know that I really wish I could have been a professor and had completed my PhD, but you know, God had other plans on that. But as we get to the end, you know, this is what, well, I'll read that part at the end. Miłosz says at the end of this, He's trying to decide whether or not he's going to be working for the center, or if he's going to, which is the communism, or whether or not he's going to choose to suffer. And he has a friend who's making fun of him for worrying about all this stuff. And he says, "The friend who warned me against incurring wrath of Zeus is a philosopher. He lives amid his books, knowing that no matter how much the human material may tremble, there will be no lack of beautiful editions of Lucretius printed in Moscow. As the new society expands, more and more classics will be re-edited." He says, "I really had certain assets," this is Miłosz talking about himself, "that could have assured my future happiness. In a Warsaw rebuilding its ruins, I would have been working in harmony with the laws of history. I would have translated Shakespeare. What joy it is to breach a language barrier and find sentences as concise as the original. I would have undertaken Marxist studies on 16th century England. Maybe I would have become a university professor. From time to time, I would have published a poem stating my loyalty to the revolution and its founders, moving in the circles of the philosophers and occupying myself with dialectics. I would have treated the efforts of writers, painters, and musicians very lightly, knowing their art is and must be bad. I would have listened to Bach and read Swift or Flaubert. Yet I deceived my friend. What led me to do this, I myself find it hard to define. If I could express it, I would be a wise man, a teacher of philosophers. I believe that my motives lie deep in my past, in an incident I shall recount." Miłosz continues on, and as he proceeds in this recount, what he talks about is going to Moscow for a little bit, and he's at the train station. And he describes a scene where propaganda is coming over the loudspeakers. People are moving from train to train. It's cold out. And then he sees a peasant family, a husband and wife, and two children. They had settled down by the wall. They were sitting on baskets and bundles. The wife was feeding the younger child. The husband, who had a dark, wrinkled face and a black, drooping mustache, was pouring tea out of a kettle into a cup for the older boy. They were whispering to each other in Polish. Now keep in mind, Miłosz is Polish. "I gazed at them until I felt moved to the point of tears. What had stopped my steps so suddenly and touched me so profoundly was their difference. This was a human group, an island in a crowd that lacked something proper to humble ordinary human life. The gesture of a hand pouring tea, the careful, delicate handling of the cup to the child, the worried words I guessed from the movement of their lips, their isolation, their privacy in the midst of the crowd, that is what moved me. For a moment then I understood something that quickly slipped from my grasp. Polish peasants were certainly far from the summits of civilization. It is possible that the family I saw was illiterate. My friend would have called them graceless, smelly imbeciles who had to be taught to think. In the circles in which my friend lives, to call man a mystery is to insult him. They have set out to carve a new man, much as a sculptor carves a statue out of the block of stone, by chipping away what is unwanted. I think they are wrong, that their knowledge is in all its perfection is insufficient, and their power over life and death is usurped. Being on the side of that stammering and mumbling with which human beings try to express themselves in their lonely helplessness. Could I have walked on the thick carpet of my apartment in a neighborhood reserved for privileged people and savored Shakespeare instead of the hand through which warm blood flows from the heart to the fingers holding my pen? They would have given me an excellent artificial hand, the dialectic." Earlier on, Miłosz talks about receiving a letter from a mother and her two daughters, in which they have been exiled to Siberia. And I've said this before on Twitter. When I went to seminary, we studied the problem of evil from a very intellectual, cold, kind of rationalistic approach. You know, why does evil happen? But I don't think that's the right way to study it anymore. I think that in order for you to study this appropriately, you need to really, especially for Christians, we need to understand the problem of evil better. And Christians today just don't understand it. And you can tell when you bring up something like a prayer request, like you're sick or somebody's got a problem or maybe things are headed towards a bad direction at your job or whatever. Somebody says, you know, but don't forget, you know, God's got this, or, you know, just remember, have faith or something. At the end of the day, we as Christians are called to have a theology of defeat, a theology of loss, a theology of suffering, or a theology of evil. We have to have that in our theology. We have to understand that even if God doesn't deliver us from the furnace, he's still God. But most of the time when people say, you know, God's a big God or God's got this or whatever, that's not part of what they mean. And if it is, they're not going to tell you because that would discourage you. Hey, you know, I know you've got, you know, I know you're really sick and you're not feeling great, but just so you know, if you die, God's got it. And that would be callous. But at the same time, just saying that God's got this doesn't really say anything either, does it? Miwosh says, yet the letter I one day held in my hand was painful. It came from a family deported to Siberia from one of the Baltic states in March 1949 and was addressed to relatives in Poland. The family consisted of a mother and two daughters. Their letter was a terse account of their work on a Kolkhoz. The last letters of every line were slightly stressed, and reading vertically, one made out the words, "Eternal slave." If such a letter happened to fall into my hands, then how many other similarly disguised expressions of despair must have found their way to people who could not make any use of them? And calculating the possibilities, how many such letters remained unwritten? How many of those who might have written them died of hunger and overwork, repeating those helpless words, "eternal slave"? So what he's saying is that they wrote a letter to him, and the letters lined up at the end of each sentence to form a letter or an acronym, "eternal slave." And this leads us to closing out. Miwosh says, "Now I am homeless. A just punishment, perhaps. But perhaps I was born so that the eternal slaves might speak through my lips. Why should I spare myself? Should I not renounce what is probably the sole duty of a poet only in order to make sure that my verse would be printed in an anthology edited by the state publishing house? My friend accepts naked terror, whatever name he may choose to give it. We have parted ways. Whether the side on which I now find myself is the future victor or the future victim is not an issue here. He does not care." This is me talking. Miwosh does not care if he wins or loses. "But I know that if my friend tastes the sweet fruits of victory, this planet will be improved according to the plan for centuries. But woe to him who lives to see this happen. All the world people are now sleeping in their beds, or perhaps they're engaging in some idiotic pastime, and one might easily believe that each in his own way is doing his best to deserve destruction. But that destruction will bring no freedom. Should the power my friend worships turn out not to be historical necessity, the earth will enter a period of terrible wars and bloody revolutions. But the quest will never end, and hope will always remain." Moving on, Miwosh says, and this is the last quote, and then I'm off, which you probably, if you've made it this far, congratulations, you get a gold star. "When, as my friend suggested, I stand before Zeus, whether I die naturally or under sentence of history, I will repeat all this that I have written in as my defense. Many people spend their entire lives collecting stamps or old coins or growing tulips. I am sure that Zeus will be merciful toward people who have given themselves entirely to these hobbies, even though they are only amusing and pointless diversions. I shall say to him, 'It is not my fault that you made me a poet, and that you gave me the gift of seeing simultaneously what was happening in Omaha and Prague, in the Baltic States, and on the shores of the Arctic Ocean. I felt that if I did not use that gift, my poetry would be tasteless to me, and fame detestable. Forgive me.' And perhaps Zeus, who does not call stamp collectors and tulip growers silly, will forgive." Thanks for listening. My name's Daniel Roberts. For Solomon's Corner, keep thinking.